Good evening, everybody. Wake up. What a great turnout tonight. So nice to have you here. My name is John Holtzschneider. I'm the Dean of Libraries and University Librarian here at Virginia Commonwealth University. And on behalf of the students and faculty and staff of the university, I extend to all of you the warmest welcome to our 17th celebration of the VCU Cabell First Novelist Award. I have to express my particular thanks to all of you tonight for getting here through the rain, avoiding the basketball game, and attending this event on a particularly consequential night for our country. So we couldn't avoid scheduling this first novelist reading on election night this year. It was just unavoidable. And I know many of you are keenly interested in the outcome of tonight's contest. So during the reception and book signing afterwards, we're going to be streaming the election results live up here on the screen. So you don't have to do without it. But it does mean, I was talking to one of our guests earlier tonight, Joan Gonsko, who's right here somewhere. And she said, actually, this is a real blessing. We get to have an hour and a half where we don't have to think about this at all. So it's great. Thank you, Joan, for reminding us of that. The VCU Cabell First Novelist Award is one of our most important community engagements here at VCU, and the VCU Libraries is proud to sponsor and partner with the Cabell Associates and others to provide some of the financial and logistics support for the VCU Cabell First Novelist Program every year. It's also a great honor and privilege to act in partnership with the VCU Creative Writing Program and the Department of English and with the College of Humanities and Sciences to manage the Cabell First Novelist Award each year. VCU First Novelist Award was established way back in 2001 by faculty members Laura Browder and Tom DeHaven in the Creative Writing Program. Earlier in the program, Richmond native and VCU alumnus David Baldacci generously funded and supported the award in its early years, and I think many of you remember that. The award was renamed the Cabell First Novelist Award in 2008 as the VCU Libraries and the Cabell Associates joined with the Department of English and the MFA program to co-sponsor the award. The Cabell First Novelist Award forms an important part of the learning experience that's provided by the novel workshop class here offered by VCU's Creative Writing Program, which was, I believe, the nation's first novel writing workshop, and it remains one of the few in existence today. I'm delighted that we can hold this premier event here in Cabell Libraries Lecture Hall, which has proven to be a fabulous space for readings and events of all kinds. This space that you see is in very high demand by folks across this great university. During the last academic year, we held 352 events with over 23,000 attendees in this venue and our breakout rooms in this building. So it's kind of a mini convention center nowadays. I just learned that since July 1st, we've had over 200 events already. We're on path to break our records in the number of events, colloquia, symposia readings that we hold here in the library. So clearly a meeting and event space like this, which is specifically designed for academic pursuit and intellectual engagement, holds very high value for our VCU communities. And here's my advertisement. We need your help. We need your help to make this space truly the very best of its kind in Virginia for events like author readings and scholarly lectures of the sort that we're doing tonight. Your donations are essential to helping us fulfill and sustain the full promise of this library and this space for all of our communities. We have a lot we still need to do here so we can make all kinds of new events possible and improve the experience you have when you visit with us. So remember that at the end of the day, it's the support of people like you, all of you, that makes spaces and programs like what you're experiencing tonight possible. You can find materials about our Friends program in your chair. Stephanie, the president, our former ex-president of our Friend, previous president, is holding it up and she's waving it like a prom queen, right? That's good. And from that brochure, you can learn about the Friends of the Library and how you can help us. So please take one and consider, please, contacting us to help us with programs like the VCU Cabell First Novelist and many other events that we bring to our community. Tonight's reading marks the 10th year of co-sponsorship between the College of Humanities and Sciences, the English Department, the Cabell Associates, and the VCU Libraries to support the Cabell First Novelist Program. So this is an important landmark for us. Few partnerships anywhere have enjoyed the kind of amazing success that we've had in this collaboration. Since 2008, the VCU Cabell First Novelist Award has grown enormously in stature and in recognition, and is now a keystone literary award for writers who publish their first novel in the U.S. And, of course, it's become a keystone literary event for the VCU literary arts community and for the Virginia literary arts community, as you can see from this wonderful attendance here tonight. So many thanks, first and foremost, go out to the Cabell Associates, whose officers are here tonight, for their support to the VCU Cabell First Novelist. Founded in 1981 by Margaret Cabell, the wife of Virginia and Richmond novelist James Branch Cabell, the Cabell Associates today continue to encourage scholarly work about James Branch Cabell, to foster his legacy, and to elevate his profile as one of America's most distinguished literary artists. A writer who truly helped define the art of fantasy writing for the likes of Neil Gaiman and others, and who remains today one of the country's most distinctive historical voices of political satire. If you haven't read Cabell and you want a good laugh, go read some. You'll wish that he was alive today to write his political satire about what's going on. Joining the Cabell Associates tonight as co-sponsors are VCU's College of Humanities and Sciences, the Department of English, and the Creative Writing Program, the VCU Libraries and the VCU Friends of the Libraries, the brochures on the table, and the Barnes & Noble Bookstore at VCU, who have books in the back that our guest author will be signing tonight. And finally, we owe grateful thanks to all the many folks in the VCU Libraries and the Department of English who have done all the kinds of work for tonight so that you don't have to do any work at all. All you need to do is sit here and enjoy it. So please, a round of applause for all who made this possible. Thank you. The VCU Cabell First Novelist Award annually honors an outstanding debut novel published during the preceding calendar year. Every year, the English department receives hundreds of submissions and recruits a small army of students and faculty and staff and others from around the university to screen books and to vote on their favorites. We also have many members in our broader community in Richmond and in Central Virginia who are what I would say a well-educated lot indeed when it comes to literary fiction. And we're delighted that they also have the opportunity to participate in our review process. So in fact, later this month, community members, including VCU Friends of the Library, graduates, alumni, and library patrons, will be able to check out books from the first batch of novels for the 2019 awards, which will determine the winner from first novels published in calendar year 2018. You can find them on the first floor of James Branch Cabell Library. If you don't see the display, just ask at the desk there and they'll help you out. Guided by screener reviews, the English department chooses three finalists. These books are then sent to a panel of judges, which always includes the previous year's winner, previous other authors, and local readers, who will then choose the final winner. The diverse group of past Cabell First Novelist winners includes many novelists who have gone on to become major voices in American literary fiction. Recent winners include Angela Flournoy for her novel The Turner House, a National Book Award finalist for fiction, Boris Fishman for A Replacement Life, a captivating short first novel from a Soviet emigre with an astounding command of English. Helen Wecker for her celebrated fantasy-tinged The Golem and the Jinni. Ramona Asobal for No One Is Here Except All of Us, which is a magical tale that grapples with history and the horrors of war. And last year's amazingly funny and poignant The Wangs Versus the World by Jay Chang. So you can see that the Cabell First Novelist Award is a rigorous process, and the winners have gone on to do just amazing and wonderful things. That's why we're so proud tonight to have this year's winner, Hernan Diaz, with us. I know that you look forward to hearing him read and discuss his work, and we all look forward to seeing him in his future career after this wonderful first novel. By tradition, the Cabell First Novelist Coordinator, who organized and oversaw this entire judging process and getting things from the publishers and all of that work, has the great honor of introducing our author each year. So presenting the winning author tonight is Kate Amphinson, a third-year student in the MFA program in creative writing here at VCU, who, naturally enough, is focusing on writing fiction. So welcome, Kate.
Can everyone hear me? Better. Can you all hear me? Good evening. I'm Kate Amphinson, as was said, a fiction writer in the MFA program. I have the privilege tonight of introducing you to the work of Hernan Diaz, the winner of the 2018 Cabell First Novelist Award for his novel In the Distance. This, his first work of fiction, has been met with great acclaim. In addition to winning the Cabell Award, In the Distance was also a finalist for the Pulitzer Prize, finalist for the Penn Faulkner Award, and winner of the William Saroyan International Prize. In the Distance is remarkable in its ability to defy genre and convention, even as it poses larger questions that transcend classification altogether. From its opening pages, in which Joaquin arrives in 19th century San Francisco and begins his journey eastward in search of his brother Linus, it is immediately clear that In the Distance is a subversion of the Western genre, a reverse manifest destiny. Reviews have sought to categorize the novel by genre, with some calling it a Western and others calling it the anti-Western. One reviewer wrote, "Is it a mystical parable about a troubled world, or perhaps in a post-apocalyptic road novel drenched in blood and fire and thirst, an elaborate homage to the Odyssey, a historical novel about 19th century migration to the U.S.? The answer, of course, is simply yes. At the center of the novel lies Hakan, a man of both tenderness and strength, whose quest for his brother becomes a pilgrimage with an increasingly hazy destination. The reader follows Hakan through a land he does not know, meeting strangers whose languages he does not speak. So skillfully does Diaz capture that disorientation of foreignness that some readers have suggested that In the Distance is a work of magical realism. But in crafting Hakan's sense of radical isolation, Diaz drew upon his own life experiences living in Argentina, Sweden, London, and finally New York, where he is now a scholar at Columbia University and serves as the associate director of the university's Hispanic Institute for Latin American and Iberian Cultures. "How do you write emptiness?" said Diaz in an interview last year. "How do you stretch and dilate the present without distorting it?" The tale is one of cruelty and unbearable loneliness and of human inclination toward both evil and good. Hakan commits a singular act of violence and retreats back to the desert, devastated. Time passes, and he grows ever larger in both physical form and in reputation. His brushes with civilization are more cold and alien than the desert wilderness. Diaz has spoken of his fascination with the Western and, as he puts it, the genre's state of derelict semi-abandonment by the American literary tradition, noting that the Western embraces America's most potent mythologies about itself and its own genesis by romanticizing the worst aspects of the imperial drive of the United States, including brutality against nature, genocidal racism, sexism, vigilantism, greed, plunder, and guns. Diaz saw an opening and sought to, in his words, hijack and repurpose the genre to say something new about the United States, to say something new, perhaps, about our immigrant roots, about how events and individuals become mythologized and how truth becomes distorted and how the American experience has always been that of the foreigner. Diaz wrestles with the larger questions that have haunted the history of America since its birth, questions of uprootedness and foreignness. As Diaz himself put it, who has a voice and who does not? Who is allowed to tell their story and who is silenced? It is no accident that so many reviewers sought to identify, to name, the specific genre into which In the Distance falls. Like Hakan, we are all searching for our bearings, unsure what remains out there on the horizon and what is a mirage. As Diaz writes in the novel, Hakan looked out at the plain until it became vertical, a surface to be climbed rather than traversed, and he wondered what he would find on the other side if he made it all the way up and straddled the sepia wall stretching into the drained, dim sky. Please join me in welcoming Armand Diaz.
Thank you all for being here. This is such an honor. And I know it's an important night, so I doubly appreciate your effort coming out here. I'm very, very grateful. I really want to thank a few people before I read a few passages out of the book. Obviously, a big thank you to VCU and its library and the library donors and the Capital Associates. Thank you to the readers and volunteers and judges. And thank you, Kate, especially for those lovely words. That was great, and they almost kind of rendered the whole Q&A pointless because we're done. Thank you, Gregory, whom I haven't met. Thank you, Lina Maria. Looking forward to our conversation. And endless thanks to Hannah. Really, I feel so honored and grateful. I also need to thank Chris Fischbach, who's taking my picture as I speak. Chris is the fearless, amazing leader of Coffee House Press. They published my book when nobody would. Yes. Chris changed my life. I'm very grateful. Thank you for flying all the way from Minnesota tonight. And thank you also to my brilliant friend, Heather Cleary, who's joining us tonight, also from New York. Heather is a great translator, scholar, thinker, and artist, and a dear, dear friend. And She was very instrumental in the publication of this book as well. So I'm very happy to be able to share this moment with her. Lastly, heartfelt thanks to the students in the MFA program here for reading the book, for being part of this whole process. I think this whole program and the novel workshop is absolutely amazing, and I still can't believe that in some way this book was a part of this program, and I'm very grateful and touched. So thank you to all the students who are here. Well, let's read a few passages out of the book. I think I will read three passages. It would be between 10 and 15 minutes, not more than that. So the book narrates the travails and difficulties of this young Swedish immigrant whose name is Håkan Söderström. He's Swedish. Söderström, by the way, in Swedish means southern current, which is the invisible current that is in this book, which is so obviously about Sweden and the United States, and mostly about the United States. I grew up in Sweden, but I was born in Argentina. And Argentina has this great literary tradition that is called gauchesca literature, about gauchos, which are not exactly cowboys, but close enough. So I drew a lot from the American 19th century tradition, but also secretly from that southern stream, and that's why I thought I would give Håkan that last name, Söderström. So Håkan leaves for New York, and things don't go so well for him. The story begins aboard a ship that has been iced in Alaska, and Håkan, who is now an old man, tells the story of his life. Håkan Söderström was born on a farm north of Lake Tisnaden in Sweden. The exhausted land his family worked belonged to a wealthy man they had never met, although he regularly collected his harvest through his estate manager. With crops failing year after year, the landlord had tightened his fist, forcing the Söderströms to subsist on mushrooms and berries they foraged for in the woods, and eels and pikes they caught in the lake, where Håkan, encouraged by his father, acquired a taste for ice baths. Most families in the region led similar lives, and within a few years, as their neighbors abandoned their homes, heading for Stockholm or farther south, the Söderströms became increasingly isolated until they lost all contact with people, except the manager, who came a few times a year to collect his dues. The youngest and eldest sons fell ill and died, leaving only Håkan and his brother Linus, 4 years his senior. They lived like castaways. Days passed without a word being uttered in the house. The boys spent as much time as they could out in the woods or in the abandoned farmhouses, where Linus told Håkan story after story, adventures he claimed to have lived, accounts of exploits supposedly heard firsthand from their heroic protagonists, and narratives of remote places he somehow seemed to know in detail. Given their seclusion and the fact that they did not know how to read, the source of all these tales could only have been Linus's prodigious imagination. Yet, however outlandish the stories, Håkan never doubted his brother's words. Perhaps because Linus always defended him unconditionally and never hesitated to take the blame and the blows for any of his brother's small misdoings, Håkan trusted him without reservation. It is true that he most likely would have died without Linus, who always made sure he had enough to eat, managed to keep the house warm while their parents were away, and distracted him with stories when food and fuel were scarce. Everything changed when the mayor became pregnant. During one of his brief visits, the manager told Erik, Håkan's father, to make sure everything went well. They had already lost too many horses to the famine, and his master would welcome an addition to his dwindling stable. Time went on, and the mare got abnormally big. Erik was not surprised when she gave birth to twins. Perhaps for the first time in his life, he decided to lie. Together with the boys, he cleared a spot in the woods and built a hidden pen, to which he took the foals as soon as it was weaned. A few weeks later, the manager came and claimed its brother. Erik kept his colt hidden, making sure it grew strong and healthy. When the time came, he sold it to a miller in a distant town where nobody knew him. The evening of his return, Erik told his sons they were leaving for America in 2 days. The money from the colt was enough for only 2 fares, and anyway, he was not going to flee like a criminal. Their mother said nothing. Håkan and Linus, who had never even seen a picture of the city, hurried down to Gothenburg, hoping to spend a day or two there, but they barely made it in time to get on their ship to Portsmouth. Once on board, they divided up their money in case something happened to one of them. During this leg of the trip, Linus told Håkan everything about the wonders that awaited them in America. They spoke no English, so the name of the city they were headed for was an abstract talisman to them, New York. They arrived in Portsmouth much later than expected, and everyone was in a great hurry to get on the rowboats that took them to shore. As soon as Håkan and Linus set foot on the wharf, they were sucked in by the current of people bustling up and down the main road. They walked side by side, almost jogging. Now and then, Linus turned to his brother to teach him something about the oddities around them. Both of them were trying to take it all in as they looked for the next ship, which was to leave that very afternoon. Merchants, incense, tattoos, wagons, fiddlers, steeples, sailors, sledgehammers, flags, steam, beggars, turbans, goats, mandolin, cranes, jugglers, baskets, sailmakers, billboards, harlots, smokestacks, whistles, organ, weavers, hookers, hookahs, peddlers, peppers, puppets, fistfights, cripples, feathers, conjurer, monkeys, soldiers, chestnuts, silk, dancers, cockatoo, preachers, ham, auctions, accordionists, dyes, acrobats, belfries, carpets, fruits, clotheslines. Håkan looked to his right, and his brother was gone. They had just passed a group of Chinese seamen having lunch, and Linus had told his brother some facts about their country and its traditions. They had kept walking, gaping and wide-eyed, looking at the scenes around them, and then Håkan had turned to Linus, but he was no longer there. He looked around, backtracked, walked from the curb to the wall, ran forward and then back to their landing place. The rowboat was gone. He returned to the spot where they had lost each other. He got in a crate, short-breathed and trembling, screamed his brother's name and looked down at the torrent of people. A salty fizz on his tongue quickly became a numbing tingle that spread over his entire body. Barely able to steady his quaking knees, he rushed to the nearest pier and asked some sailors in a dinghy from New York. The sailors did not understand. After many attempts, he tried America. They got that immediately, but shook their heads. Håkan went pier by pier, asking for America. Finally, after several failures, someone said America back to him and pointed to a rowboat and then to a ship anchored about 3 cable lengths off the shore. Håkan looked into the boat. Linus was not there. Perhaps he had already boarded the ship. A sailor offered Håkan his hand, and he got on. As soon as they got to the ship, someone demanded and took his money, and then showed him to a dark corner below deck, where among berths and chests and bundles and barrels, under swinging lanterns hanging from beams and ringbolts, loud clusters of emigrants tried to settle in and claim some small space of the cabbage and stable-smelling steerage as their own for the long trip. He looked for Linus among the silhouettes distorted by the quivering light, making his way through screaming and sleeping babies, laughing and haggard women, and sturdy and weeping men. With increasing despair, he rushed back on deck through waving crowds and busy sailors. The ship was clearing off visitors. The gangplank was removed. He shouted his brother's name. The anchor was lifted. The ship moved. The crowds cheered. I know you probably won't believe this, but I think I will improvise. And I will read 2 more passages, but they won't be in chronological order, just because I feel it's better that way. So the passage I will read next is only 3 minutes long, and it's much later in the book. And Håkan has been alone for a really long time out in the desert, in the mountains, in the plains. And he is in a self-imposed exile and can't really face human society anymore. It's very cold. A very brutal winter is coming on. He's trying to make a coat for himself so that he won't freeze to death. And he's very good at dissecting and pelting animals. Through the light snowflakes that melted before touching the ground came the cry of a baby. As always, Håkan's first reaction was to wrestle his horse and burro down. This is what he does when he feels that someone is coming at him. He wrestles his animals down to hide. As always, Håkan's first reaction was to wrestle his horse and burro down. In the mist, the weeping continued. The small, airy drops felt like a cold halo hovering over his face, contrasting with the warm glow coming from the horse's muscles twitching under his cheek. No voices of men or women, no jingling of harnesses or creaking of springs, no rumbling of wagons or tramping of beasts, just the lonely wail. Håkan's horse got restless, but he pressed on his neck and made him stay down. A long time went by. The weeping never stopped, always issuing from the same spot in the white mist. Other than the cries, complete silence. It stopped snowing. The fog thickened. Cramped and soaked, Håkan got up, mounted his horse, and rode into the curling clouds. With each step, the wails grew louder. The plains barely insisted against the fog. Håkan got out his knife. As he moved along, the ground ahead of him faded into reality from the whiteness ahead. Then, in a slight depression by some shrubs, a lion took shape. It was lying in a pool of its own blood, lightened by the snowfall. Next to it, a wailing blind cub. It was getting hoarse. Håkan dismounted and immediately saw that the cougar had died trying to give birth to its second breached offspring, still stuck halfway out. Håkan rolled the mother over and put the crying kitten to one of her feet. From its outstretched hind legs to its head, the lion was taller than Håkan. The cub nursed greedily. After a few moments, realizing that nothing came out, it started crying again. Håkan tried to milk the lion. Then he went through his provisions and offered the kitten everything he had. Charqui, sugar water, dried meat from different animals, oats, bacon, and moistened biscuits. Håkan now heard rage in the cub's desperate cries. He made a cut into his own forearm and put the kitten's snout to the blood, but it would not taste it. Håkan looked into the crying mouth and saw the ribbed vault of the palate, the sharp little teeth, and the white scales on the pink tongue. He smelled the clean breath coming from the empty stomach. Then he looked into the creature's watery eyes and wrung its neck. Mother and cub were skinned. And to end on a brighter note, I thought I would read from a passage earlier on in the book, which, come to think of it, is almost the opposite, in a weird way, of what you just heard. So we're going back in time in the book. Håkan has been out on the plains, the west, for over a year. He has been captured by this woman who runs a criminal gang, and she's held him hostage for about a year. And he's managed to escape. He's wandering around the desert and is picked up by a naturalist whose name is John Lorimer. John Lorimer has a theory of evolution he has been working on for a long time. This is right before Darwin, and he almost gets it right, not quite. And he takes Håkan under his wing and teaches him anatomy, and they dissect animals together so that Lorimer can sort of expound his evolutionary theory with these bodies of these animals. So this is what's happening now. their small caravan moved on, leaving a trail of slashed birds, dogs, reptiles, and rodents. During their lessons, Lorimer often reminded his student that his remarkable talent with the scalpel would amount to nothing if the knife was not held by a loving hand guided by a truth-seeking eye. The study of nature is a barren enterprise if stones, plants, and animals become frozen under the magnifying glass, Lorimer said. A naturalist should look at the world with warm affection, if not ardent love. The life the scalpel has ended ought to be honored by a caring, devoted appreciation for that creature's unrepeatable individuality, and for the fact that, at the same time, strange as this may seem, this life stands for the entire natural kingdom. Examined with attention, the dissected hair illuminates the parts and properties of all other animals and, by extension, their environment. The hair, like a blade of grass or a piece of coal, is not simply a small fraction of the whole, but contains the whole within itself. This makes us all one, if anything, because we are all made of the same stuff. Our flesh is the debris of dead stars, and this is also true of the apple and its tree, of each hair on the spider's legs, and of the rock rusting on planet Mars. Each minuscule being has spokes radiating out to all of creation. Some of the raindrops falling on the potato plants in your farm back in Sweden were once in a tiger's bladder. From one living thing, the properties of any other may be predicted. Looking at any particle with sufficient care and following the chain that links all things together, we can arrive at the universe. The correspondences are there if the eye is skillful enough to detect them. The guts of the anatomized hair faithfully render the picture of the entire world. And because that hair is everything, it is also us. Having understood and experienced this marvelous congruity, man can no longer examine his surroundings merely as a surface scattered with alien objects and creatures related to him only by their usefulness. The carpenter, who can only devise tabletops while walking through the forest. The poet, who can only remember his own private sorrows while looking at the falling snow. The naturalist, who can only attach a label to every leaf and a pin to every insect. All of them are debasing nature by turning it into a storehouse, a symbol, or a fact. Knowing nature, Lorimer would often say, means learning how to be. And to achieve this, we must listen to the constant sermon of things. Our highest task is to make out the words, to better partake in the ecstasy of existence. Håkan had been converted. Thank you.